Americans for the Arts.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the the Health and Nutrition Program with Dr. Fred Harvey, MD. Fred is here. He drove up from Sarasota this morning. I'm Rob Lori. We're going to talk about health and nutrition and take your phone calls and your email questions. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Fred, Happy New Year. How are you?
Happy New Year. I'm great. How are you today, Rob?
I'm good. Except I was reading in the paper in Sarasota this morning that the red tide has returned to Sarasota, and I thought, Oh no. Yeah. So did you have any direct or indirect experience with red tide?
It seems to have broken up over the holidays, but it's back. My son went surfing over the weekend, and he said it was stinky out there and saw a few dead fish. And I just heard the report on the way up that, yes, all off of Siesta and Lido, it looks bad again.
Oh, no. That's terrible. Well, let's talk about other health and nutrition issues. I was looking at this study over the New Year's holiday. According to the World Health Organization, 80% of all cases of heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes are preventable by eating healthier. And then in a sea of diets, this article says, one is prevailing in improving heart health. It is the Mediterranean diet. So do you think the World Health Organization is right that we could reduce heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes just simply by eating healthier?
It's really on target. They know what they're talking about. The nature of what we eat is so critical. We are what we eat. And when we put these things into us that really aren't foods, we start to disrupt things. So, food science has done an amazing job of making tasty food-like substances available for us. The key there is they are food-like substances. With all these different, I would guess, petrochemical derivative things in it that are to stabilize it, to allow for shelf life and ongoing flavor, they're risky. And the use of pesticides and herbicides in industrial agriculture results in toxins in our foods that actually accelerate illness. When I was in medical school and even for the 20 years afterwards, we really talked about how when someone gets obese and gets diabetes, you have to watch for heart disease. Diabetes often leads down the path to heart disease. But about two or three years ago, a study was published that showed that when you look at people with diabetes and track them on into the heart attack or the stroke, if you look for confounding influences, you might find something different. And they did. And that is that people that had no toxins in their system went on to not develop heart disease, not to get the heart attack. But people that had petrochemical toxins like herbicides, pesticides, and toxic metals as well, like mercury and arsenic, people that had these in their bodies actually developed the heart disease and the heart attack. And so we really have to pay attention to eating organic and eating not organic, because if we're eating lots of not organic foods, and we know that like 97% of all the soy products in America are not organic, and they're genetically modified to accept being sprayed with the herbicide Roundup glyphosate. And so that stuff is in the food, and it's a petrochemical, so it's fat soluble. So when you actually get soybean oil, you're actually concentrating some of those pesticides, herbicides into the oil. So any thing that you read on the label that has soybean oil that doesn't say organic is actually incorporating these toxins in that accelerate the process. When I was at a lecture on the diabetes, and we call it, I guess, the diabesity epidemic, America's getting fat and having problems with sugar metabolism. When you do an overlay of the country where the highest concentration on a map, look at the map and you see in the center of the country, in the bread belt essentially, Middle America has the most amount of diabetes and obesity. And they also have the highest amount of atrazine pesticide poisoning. The highest concentrations in the groundwater in those areas. there's a direct correlation.
So you think it's more eating organic than it is, you know, whether you're eating mostly grains, fruits, vegetables, processed food? I mean, do you think it's organic is the number one thing to consider as opposed to the kind of
I think
meat,
they're parallel.
Dairy?
Or? I think they're really equal. I think you really need to look at the food composition, and the Mediterranean diet is what we've been eating as a species for millennia. And it really appears to be the diet that is best for us. There are benefits in certain people and detriments in certain people for doing really specialized diets like a ketogenic diet or a paleo diet or a vegetarian diet. But because I have a client that you know can't eat animal products because he feels horrible when he does. So he's vegetarian. He actually does very well paying close attention to vegetarian foods because he gets his proteins out of his beans and things. But the Mediterranean diet is really a plant-based diet. It's 80% plant. If you really look at the way the Mediterraneans ate 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago, it was plants. We ate a lot of plants. And then we, you know, caught some fish, little fish, with nets. That's mostly what it was. When in the Bible they were feeding the masses with the fish, it wasn't line-caught fish. They would net a bunch of little sardines. And that's why you have enough for a lot of people because everybody gets a sardine. So eating this high omega fat oil, close to the ground diet, think about it. 2,000 years ago, we didn't have pesticides. We ate vegetables that weren't covered with nasties. We ate grains that weren't genetically manipulated. So if we could eat as close to the ground, as close to nature as possible, and eat a plant-based diet, 80% plant, 20% animal, we're looking at heart health.
Well, when you talked about heavy metals, I was thinking about that photo I saw last week in the news of a Japanese millionaire who spent millions of dollars on this king tuna, this giant tuna
yes.
that they had come fish out of the Pacific. But I was thinking that if I like sushi, but if you eat a lot of the kind of like giant fish, you're eating a lot of heavy metals, right?
That is so true. The bigger the fish, the more time it has to concentrate the metals. The way it comes to the fish is that the mercury is in the water, and the plankton are basically living and breathing the water. So they incorporate it into them, and then little fish eat the plankton. Bigger fish eat the littler fish, and then the huge king tuna come around, and they just munch on the bigger fish. The whole process is concentrated the mercury into the fish oil because the mercury doesn't, no living body wants the mercury around because it's a poison. So it sequesters it in the fat so it doesn't move around the body and cause damage. So the fattier fish, like the big blue tuna, they have real high mercury levels. So the millionaire bought millions of dollars worth of mercury.
Mm. And so what I see on the local menus here, I see a lot of swordfish in restaurants in
yes.
Florida, which is a big fish.
Yes.
And that also is concentrating heavy metals, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Swordfish, shark, tuna, let's see what else is up there. Oh, tilefish is a big one. Lobster. People don't think about lobster, but it lives at the bottom and it gets really big. They can get really old, so they concentrate a lot of mercury in them.
Is the same true for shellfish? I mean, am I eating heavy metals if I'm eating shellfish?
Like shrimp?
Yeah. Or clams? Or
clams. Well, there's a difference. So crustaceans, shrimp running around, they can escape some of the toxins. So Key West pinks, fresh caught, or maybe frozen in a bag, they're pretty safe because they're away from industrial pollution a lot. But if you get some, and I hate to really go here, but I mean, Apalachicola browns are really delicious, but BP spilled up there, and they continue to do so. I don't trust them from certain areas. And then the problem with bivalves or the shell fish, like clams, oysters, they can't get away. They're stuck where we dump our sewage. And yes, you can get them in really pristine areas. And occasionally I'll have an oyster from like Drake's Bay, California, which has only organic runoff from the West Coast. It's on Point Reyes National Monument. It's like thousands of acres of clean. But, you know, it's outside of San Francisco Bay. So I don't know what effluvium is coming out of the bay and getting there. But I think the circulation is the opposite direction. So Drake's Bay oysters are clean. They're pristine and delicious. But Apalachicola oysters scare me again because where did that BP oil spill go? Mixed up with that stuff they injected, and it's there.
Dr. Fred Harvey is here, and this is WMNF in Tampa, our health and nutrition program, and our phone number is 813-239-9663. So I guess we've learned several things, and we've talked about these before. Mediterranean diet is the healthiest. You can reverse heart disease and a potential for stroke, and you can reverse the effects of type 2 diabetes by simply changing your diet.
It's so true.
There is hope. Fred, you were telling me about a New York Times op-ed by Nicholas Kristof
that
you liked.
You know, over the holidays, it's a time for a lot of stress for people. And we can feel down because we're lonely or a lot of other things. And then, you know, right now we have so many things kind of brewing in our society. And it's been going on for years. We always have, you know, the news cycle reports bad news because it sells. And so we tend to focus a lot on the bad. And Nick Kristof is such a cool guy because every year he writes an article saying this last year we just came out of was the best year in history. And he's really correct because every year it just keeps getting better. He says, you know, what is the antidote to the gloom? Let's try to make the case that this was the best year in human history. Each day on average, another 295,000 people around the world got electricity for the first time. And every day, another 305,000 were able to access clean drinking water for the first time. And 620,000 people were able to get online for the first time. It's never been like this ever in the history of our planet. We're getting better. Poverty is going away. We're down below 9% of the entire population of the planet in abject poverty, which means less than $2 a day, which is pretty scary. But it's just, it's such a good feeling to hear that the world is doing this. It bothers me, and you just mentioned this, that America's going the other direction. Yes.
Life expectancy is dropping in the U.S.
Yes. Yeah.
So I hate to be a downer. I mean, I like Nicholas Kristof's upbeat, optimistic projection, but here in the U.S., we've got our own set of problems, including poverty that is intractable right now.
That is so true. Yeah. And an increasing inequity in wealth. And that really contributes to lots of stress, lots of problems, and makes, you know, really stress is the killer. And people who are in poverty and have ill health and don't have access really are actually in a worse situation because they're close to the access. They can see the luxury across the street, and it makes it even harder on our society and divides it even more. And so to really look at what we're doing, I mean, we're 5% of the human global population, and we consume 70% of the opiate drugs. There's something wrong with this picture. The opiates are a toxin, by the way, and we're toxifying ourselves.
Well, how so?
Well, it's a petrochemical that it's something that our body has never seen before. Now, morphine from the opium poppy is an exogenous substance that, in a sense, is still a toxin. It will kill us if we overdose on it, and it causes our liver to do extra work. So it's got to metabolize through these exogenous substances. But when they're xenobiotic or outside of actual the life cycle, they're created in a laboratory, they're even harder to metabolize, and they create all kinds of extra problems for us. Like Tylenol itself is one of the most toxic substances on the planet if you don't have the liver detox mechanism to get rid of it. And it's really simple. It's protein. N-acetylcysteine is an amino acid that detoxifies Tylenol. But if you don't have that on board, we don't have the lead singer of Toto with us anymore. Remember Toto from the 80s?
Yeah.
They had such success and were having such a good party in LA that he spent a month on Coke and alcohol. Depleted his liver of all nutrients, and then he took one Tylenol for the hangover headache when he woke up. After that month, his liver was gone in 2 days and he was dead in a week because they couldn't get a transplant for him. Wow. Because he had no reserves. It's the toxins that are really the worst part of it.
Is there any natural alternative to opiates? Any herbal or...
That's an interesting thought. I was just reading an article today about medical marijuana.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would love to say, yes, we know. There is some evidence that it helps pain. We don't know how. We don't know any kind of dose-response relationship. It seems to be a unique medication, drug, substance, chemical, in that it seems to have a different dose response in different people. And so... if anyone is interested in exploring medical marijuana and understanding it more, I would suggest that everyone listening today contact their congressman, their senator, and even write to the FDA, write to the DEA, and say, take marijuana off the schedule. Put it on Schedule 5 because it's obviously no more toxic than an anti-diarrhea medicine like diphenoxylate.
Because right now it's a Schedule One drug, which is listed as dangerous as heroin. Is that right?
As dangerous as heroin, with no medicinal benefits, and so it should be completely banned.
I mean, these are the feds, not the local state governments.
This is the feds.
Yeah.
And so the DEA has the ability to move this off the Schedule One banned drug area. I mean, what they should really do is move methamphetamine and amphetamine onto the Schedule One, because I don't see any medical benefit. I know I'll get pushback from this because there's people that take it and feel that they do better, but there are natural ways to do that and get your focus back and not have the ADHD type symptoms for which people are taking speed.
What are the natural alternatives?
Well, you have to look at the person in real broad terms, like the functional medicine does, but there could be food sensitivities, artificial substance sensitivities. You could be having your mind distracted by tartrazine yellow dye number 5 that's showing up in your Skittles, and you don't even know that that's doing that. And then other basic things, like we talked about the Mediterranean diet, getting the real close to the ground whole food substances in, and exercise and meditation and brain games and acupuncture. There's all kinds of layers of things that we can do to help the whole system be able to focus and do its job the right way.
Let's take some phone calls, and we're going to open up the phone lines right now. 813-239-9663. Dr. Fred Harvey is here. He's an MD from Sarasota, and he is our new host of the Health and Nutrition Program. Here's an email from Anonymous. They write, you spoke of detox drops last time you were on the air. What are detox drops?
That's a great question, and it follows right in with what we're talking about here. Thank you. So homeopathic remedies are medications that work slightly differently, or quite differently, from what we think of in Western medicine terms of medical intervention. So when we take a pill from a Western medicine doctor or from my prescription pad, it is a biochemical substance that specifically acts on something in your physiology in your body. But the homeopathic remedies work more on a subtle energetic type of mechanism. It's more like quantum physics. And if you can think of a wave, in science, if you have a wave of an equal and opposite generation, so you have on a wave, you have ups and downs. If they have 180 degrees opposite polarity, essentially, the waves cancel out to a flat line. And that's the way I like to think about the way homeopathy works. When you use that, it neutralizes the bad energies of whatever might be in you, or it works with the energies of your body to help it do what it needs to do better. And so with drainer or drainage, it's from Zymogen or Newton homeopathics. It's a compound homeopathic that has many different remedies all in one, and it suggests to your organs of detox, your kidneys, your liver, your colon, your lymphatics, your sweat glands, to release toxins. And so it doesn't interact with most medications. If you have a problem with alcohol, it's only 6 drops of alcohol per dose, but you can get it in lactose tablets too. And what they do is just help your body do its job better. And it doesn't directly chelate out metals or do it like a gut cleanse detox like many people would think of when they think about a detox.
Who would be the prime candidate? What kinds of people would be the prime candidate for taking detox drops?
Humans. Every one of us.
For people that consume too much of something, that's what I was getting at.
Well, true. Everybody on the planet's exposed to toxins at this point. We just can't avoid it. So everybody should take some drainage drops, I think, because it just helps your body remember to take out the trash. But so I keep a bottle in my car just in case I'm on a trip and I get trapped behind a bus and have been breathing nasty exhaust fumes. I'll take 6 drops of drainage drops so that I can move that along. If you've eaten too much and overdone it, maybe drank too much and you're feeling queasy or bloated, 6 drops may help. You may get an untoward event though, because what detox drops do, or drainage drops do, is help you facilitate the removal of the toxins. So you may end up actually getting rid of it faster than you expected. It may induce vomiting. It may induce some diarrhea. It may induce lots of urination. But generally it doesn't do this because most people aren't that toxic that acutely, and so it moves through the system much more subtly.
All right, here's our next question. And by the way, Frank Knox is our phone producer today, and you can call in with your question at 813-239-9663. John's in Lakeland. He says this. It was said that tuna contains mercury. Does that mean or imply that canned tuna contains mercury?
It does indeed. Every tuna contains mercury. Different tunas contain different amounts. Smaller fish contain less mercury. So if you're looking for, if you love tuna and you want to eat tuna and you want to avoid as much mercury as possible, you look at the small fish. So you don't do albacore, sushi grade steak tuna, because that's the highest amount because it's the biggest fish. Tongol, T-O-N-G-O-L, is a small tuna. And that shows up quite often in better stores. And you can also go online and look at Vital Choice and Safe Catch. Both are really high quality, low mercury seafood places. The stuff's a little more expensive, but it's really good quality. You can get some of the best sardines in the world there from Portugal. And if you go to smaller fish and you can deal with the fishiness of them, because that's where the good omega-3 fats are anyway. That fish flavor is omega-3 oils. Mm. So if you're avoiding fish flavor, you're avoiding the good part of it.
All right. So do you go to a sushi bar?
Periodically. And I like sushi, and I do occasionally have a hand-rolled spicy tuna roll, but it's, you know, once every 2 or 3 months, because I just don't eat that much tuna. I love it too. Mm. I just don't want to get that much mercury. So I stick with local fish. And actually, it's really interesting. If you go online and just search for Safe Fish Florida, you'll come up with a bunch of different directions to websites that are done by the state of Florida. And one of them, and I can't tell you what the exact address is, but you'll find it. It's a 40 or 50 page report of every estuarine basin and lake in Florida where the state of Florida has tested the fish and tell you which ones you can eat and how much. It's really interesting. So when I go to the local fish store and see where the flounder came from, I tend to avoid the flounder that was caught off Pinellas and eat the one that's caught off Daytona, because the southern flounder from Daytona has much less mercury than the Gulf flounder off Pinellas.
I wonder why that is.
Well, we have a major industrial problem in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's something that as we go green, we will start to fix. There are so many oil rigs in the Gulf that spew off nasty toxins like this. There is mercury actually in all fossil fuel. So when you burn coal or you burn oil, you're getting mercury. When you have the largest refinery in the world in Houston, Texas, its effluvium puts mercury across the Gulf that floats onto the Gulf and then onto Florida. Mm. And when you have an electric company in the Bay Area here,
Tampa Electric,
that lied about its scrubbers on its stacks for years and put 3,600 tons of mercury over Florida, we have a mercury problem in lake fish, in estuarine fish, all over the place.
All right, so do you eat grouper?
Local? I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty safe fish?
Well, grouper's a bigger fish, so it definitely shows up on the reports. And I think the last time I read, it suggested one serving weekly was okay for grouper.
Wild-caught salmon's okay?
Yes. And actually, again, you want to look for the smaller salmon if you want to get lower mercury, because king salmon is the biggest fish. So it's going to have a bit more, but it's a pretty good ratio to the omega-3s versus like the tuna with its mercury and omega-3 ratio. It's bad. Mm-hmm. But if you want good priced wild-caught tuna, get it in a can, or wild-caught salmon, get it in a can.
At a lot of menus around here, you see farm-raised fish and tilapia. What do you think of the farm-raised fish, and what do you think of a fish like tilapia?
Well, I think tilapia is probably going to be a food crop for many years to come. What we need to do is police up the animal husbandry in fish farms, because I think a lot of them are really sloppy and we get low quality, rather polluted meat out of it. But if we have really good ethical farming, I think tilapia may end up being a very large protein source for the planet, because it's going to take a while to clean up our seas. We're going to have some trouble here for quite a while, and so we're going to have other food crops to help us along. And that's, I think tilapia is a really good choice because it breeds so easily. We just have to take better care of the way we do it.
Let's go to Kevin, who's calling in from Bradenton. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Hey, Rob. I'm doing great. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question. I'm a cancer survivor, so, you know, my health has always been a little up and down since then. But I wanted to ask him if he's ever heard, and I've seen several doctors and no one has been able to tell me what's going on. I've got these ridges vertical lines in my fingernails. And, you know, they just popped up a few months ago. I've gone to my primary care, my oncologist, even a skin doctor. Nobody has an answer for what is causing this. I just wondered if he's ever heard of this. It's like a ridge, several ridges in my nails on both hands.
Going longitudinally or across the nail?
Up and down.
Okay, good. So when was the last time you had any kind of chemotherapy or treatment for the problem?
Not since 2007.
Okay, so this is a recent change. Something shifted
right.
In your protein metabolism or in your mineral metabolism. Your nails are collagen and organized into keratin plates, and it requires some enzymes that, well, for one thing, the basic building block is protein, and then certain enzymes require certain minerals and vitamins to make it go the right way. So you may have a disruption in your metabolism from something you haven't been eating or something you have been eating. And so sometimes that occurs also from an injury, but if it's on multiple nails, it's unlikely it's an injury. So
it's on all my nails.
Yeah, I'd look at getting a good micronutrient, vitamin and mineral test to see what you got going on there. SpectraCell Labs does a good one. You can access that yourself at any lab test now. And another one is called Vibrant America Labs, do a micronutrient evaluation that looks at just across the board. So something like that, and maybe looking at an amino acid profile of your urine to see if you're getting the right amount of proteins in, and just get a nutritional evaluation to see what's going on there.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much, because I've gone the regular orthodox way, and they don't seem to have any answers. So I appreciate your input, and I'm going to have to listen to this again so I can write down everything you just told.
Okay, you're very welcome.
Thanks, all right, Bob. Kevin, thanks a lot. Thank you. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And this is the Health and Nutrition Program. Dr. Fred Harvey is here, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Anonymous writes, do drainage drops help remove old chemochemicals?
That's a good question. Well, homeopathics don't necessarily remove anything, but the best way to remove old chemochemicals is make sure that you have a good bowel movement 3 times a day and drink a couple liters of water so that you can eliminate through the urine. Because your body does the detox and takes out the trash generally. So what the drainage drops will help is the actual process there. It'll tell the body to keep doing what it is, but you have to facilitate it with good food and good bowel movements and good water intake.
A bowel movement 3 times a day?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
That's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Yeah,
most people don't.
Yeah.
Gastroenterologists actually, in their literature, suggest that even up to once a week, bowel movement is considered normal human physiology. But the way I look at it is, you know, we eat a meal, and the meal gets digested, and we don't eat another meal for 4 hours or something like that. And sometimes we snack in between, but not everybody does, and we don't need it. But if we just stick to 3 meals a day, and we process those, they go through the body as a unit. And so if we're only going to the bathroom, say, once a day, we're stacking up the train cars at the station and waiting to unload them. I think it's more efficient to actually take out the freight when it gets there. And that way, you don't have the other process that I don't like, and that is in the colon, you have these really great and very beneficial bacteria. If they get to hang around with that effluvium too long, they get to re-metabolize some things, and they scavenge because they're hungry. And what they'll do is they'll take a petrochem, like a chemotherapeutic drug that's been detoxed by the liver by attaching to it an amino acid, like glucuronic acid. It's called glucuronidation. Well, the bacteria can actually break that bond apart with an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase, and it will actually release the toxin back for you to re-metabolize, and the bacteria will eat the glucuronic acid and be very happy. So it retoxifies you if you don't get rid of it frequently.
Well, how do you speed up that process?
A fiber, probiotics, lots of fluids. You got to drink a couple liters a day to keep the bowel hydrated enough to keep it going along. A lot of people don't like okra because it's, quote, slimy, right? So it's the slime that we want. because the slime is soluble fiber, and the bacteria use that to help make the bowels move right. It nourishes the lining of the colon, so the colon can make more mucus, so the mucus can help it slip through. So anything that has that soluble fiber with it, like the, anything that's got that slickness. So have you ever cut a green onion and feel the little bit of clear goo that comes out of there?
Practically every vegetable.
Yes, practically every. And some are much better than others. Okra is obvious. When you cut a papaya, it gets an ooze of a kind of a clear gel. That's a mix of papain, the digestive enzyme, and some soluble fiber. So it's actually a double whammy because the papain helps to clean the bowel too. So really getting back to it is eating lots of good fruits and vegetables.
All right, so we load up on fruits and vegetables. This is 3 bowel movements a day is possible.
It is indeed.
Whoa. All right, so here's somebody that says, thanks for explaining the detox drops. Do I ask for these at the health food store?
Actually, you can. If you ask, if they have a homeopathic section, ask them for a general drainage or detox remedy. If they don't have it, you can find it at different practitioners. There might be some other health food stores around, even Eve's Old Practice and mine. We carry them because some of the lines like Newton have a practitioner-based and also a public line. So you can find them at many different stores.
Again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can also write in your question to this address, dj@wmnf.org. Clint writes, what supplements and or foods would the doctor suggest to help bone healing in a finger fracture?
That's a good one. Protein is really important because the matrix of bones is protein. So when the bone-building cells come in and make what's called the pannus, which is the organ of healing that surrounds a fracture, it brings in protein, builds the bone structure, brings in more blood vessels, and then attaches the calcium to the protein so that the bone structure then hardens. So calcium is really important too, and vitamin D.
What proteins do you like best for healing bones?
I think as long as you're getting a good amount of protein, that's the key. So at least a gram of protein per pound of body weight a day while you're trying to heal a bone. And that's a lot of protein, actually.
But it doesn't matter whether it's beans or whether it's fish, whether it's...
Yeah, that's correct. Now, you may do a little bit better with a higher biologic value protein, meaning an animal-based protein. And meaning it's higher biologic value, and that's a dietetics term, I think, really indicating that animals tend to be structurally animal. And so whey protein or beef or something like that is more structurally like our protein, so it's easier to incorporate more of it.
So dairy in this case is good?
Dairy is very good, yes.
Yeah.
You want to do organic dairy, obviously.
Right.
And then there's a really interesting supplement called orthosilicic acid, and it's an organic silica. And this organic silica is a kind of a linchpin in collagen formation. So when you ingest the protein, you have to digest it, break it down into amino acids, bring it into the body, and then the body takes those raw material amino acids and rebuilds your collagen. And so you need this orthosilicic acid. And then two other really critical amino acids there in the process are proline and lysine. And so adding maybe a lysine proline supplement, I've seen those on the shelf, that might be a good idea too. But I think if you just get good amounts of the protein itself and some vitamin D and calcium. Calcium is a really good source for calcium. You can get it in your protein and your calcium in one source, canned salmon. They cook the bones into the salmon, so you get high-dose calcium and high-dose protein in one little 6-ounce can of salmon.
Hmm. And do you worry about toxic metals like mercury in that canned salmon?
Not as much as I would in canned tuna.
Okay.
It's there, and I'm fine with at least 1 to 2 doses a week of salmon because at this point it's rather sustainable and not that high in mercury.
Let's go to Susan in Sarasota. Hi, Susan. You're on our health and nutrition program. What's your question for the doctor?
Dr. Harvey. Up north, my cardiologist was concerned a little bit because there's more stiffness in my heart. I said, worst case scenario, she's just congenital heart disease, and my valves have gotten leakier. Down here, the cardiologist said, oh, yes, you have asymptomatic stage 2 congestive heart failure. and we're keeping an eye on your valves. One recommended I get better with my aerobics, which I'm doing. The other said eat nothing with the face, which I almost did. I mean, I've been a pretty much of a vegan. I'm taking Hawthorne and CoQ10, and I'm doing my best, but you're a brilliant guy, and I wonder what I'm missing.
Well, that's a really broad question, and without more information, it's tough to tell you exactly what, but so valvular heart disease could be the cause of heart failure. So the question is really, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the heart failure worsen and worsen the valves, or did the valves worsen and worsen the heart?
I think this was the first year that the tightness, you know, the stiffness in the heart showed up on the echocardiogram, but I've only had two others.
So that would make me think that you may have an aortic valve problem.
Right, I do.
Okay, so this is mechanical. Your aortic valve is too tight, more than likely. And so your heart has to work harder to push against the tight valve. And when it does that, it's like a bodybuilder. It's going to build up. Virtually the only fix for that is fixing the valve, but there's a point where it becomes critical that it needs to be done, and most people don't want to do open heart until that point. We know that as the heart gets more stiff from an aortic valve problem, that the risk of heart failure and arrhythmias goes up. And statistically, there's a cutoff where they say, okay, the valve gets to this point and your heart's at this stiffness, then we should really consider doing the intervention. But before that, they don't want to. So you're doing a lot of the right things for treating your valve the right way. Aerobics is difficult when you have a valve problem. You can't do it too intensively because there's only so much blood flow that can get through that valve.
I do a half hour in the morning, half hour in the afternoon or evening, and I go interval, fast and slow.
Excellent.
I do strength training. I'm doing a little yoga, but I want to do everything I can for myself.
Excellent. And if you're tolerating all those exercises, keep doing them if they don't cause you any difficulties.
No difficulty.
And the CoQ10 is excellent. You might even take as much as 5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight.
Well, I weigh about 100 and I take 120 mg.
Yeah, you could even double that if you feel like you need more energy and need some more heart support. The stiffness of...
And I'm taking Hawthorne, and I was told that the pumping action is good.
It's good, easy. Good.
Anything I'm missing?
So supporting the heart muscles so that it's more relaxed could be magnesium.
Yep,
And also some taurine, amino acid, to help the heart structure.
Taurine. I'm doing about 1,000 a day.
Good. And L-carnitine.
L-carnitine I was told not to do because the doctor said, well, that's better. That's got to do more with the pumping.
Right, but if your pump is getting stiffer, it means that it's working harder, and support for the pump might not be a bad idea. Because
you vote for some L-carnitine?
Yeah, it might not be a bad idea. If you find that you have any symptoms, then you might want to add it. I mean, there's only so many pills you might want to take in a day. So
I've got a lot of supplements.
Good. How about fish oil?
No, but I do a vegetarian EPA DHA.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, and it wasn't hard for me to be a whole food vegan. Giving up a cup of cashews a day was hard, but I'm not very moderate anyway. I don't know how to do a handful of nuts. But I'm eating like an avocado a day, a whole one, and I'm also eating sunflower seeds, but or pumpkin or hemp. But don't you think that might be a little too much fat?
It depends. If you're not gaining weight on it, I'm not terribly worried. You could get an omega fatty acid check and see where that is. That's available through SpectraCell. Also, any lab test now. You don't even need a doctor to order it. But yeah, I think you're doing a lot of the right things. It sounds like you've made some great choices. I'd keep doing it.
Omega fatty acid profile?
Yes, exactly.
What else did I get tested?
I always like to test micronutrients too to see if all your multi-minerals and vitamins are intact and looking good. A homocysteine level can gauge.
I always do that, but where do you test the nutrients through? What kind of a lab?
I use Vibrant America, I use Genova, I use SpectraCell. A bunch of different labs have some really good micronutrient testing.
So you think I'm sort of on the right track?
I do. You sound like you're doing great. You made a lot of great decisions.
Oh, man. All right. I am concerned. I'm going to be 76, and I'd like to go at least another 30 years.
Keep going. I love it.
All right.
Nothing else that I might put in, take out.
I think you're doing great.
Thanks for talking to me.
You're welcome.
All right, Susan, thanks a lot. That sounds great. It sounds like she shows up at the health food store a lot, too.
Yes.
So if you're taking coenzyme Q10 and L-carnitine and taurine and all this stuff, is there any danger that their interaction may harm you?
That's a good question. Of those things, the only one that I've seen questions about is the L-carnitine. There were some studies done in people eating beef and in eating carnitine that had a chemical called TMAO show up. And TMAO is actually probably damaging to the arteries. And so too much carnitine or carnitine with inefficient metabolism of carnitine can create the TMAO, especially if you have an imbalanced microintestinal or microbiota in your gut, because the bacteria will ferment it into the TMAO. So if you have the right flora there, you'll probably do better. So actually, for the last caller, Susan, you might want to take a probiotic to make sure that you've got the right flora there if you're going to do the carnitine. And you're already vegan, so you're already avoiding the meat. Well, my one caveat there is if you're vegan, make sure that you're getting enough protein. It's one of the hardest things vegans have to conquer. Make sure you're getting a good amount of protein to support the body.
So how would you determine whether or not there is a bad interaction between all the vitamins and minerals and chemicals and amino acids and probiotics that you're taking? I mean, you don't want to just inadvertently, because you're taking so many of these. I mean, Susan talked about having a whole, you know, cupboard full of supplements. Is there a go-to place to find out where supplements might be contraindicated if you're taking two together?
It's called the standard. I'm blanking. So it's the standard something, or it's just the standard. Anyway, there is a database online that you can access that has a lot of nutrient drug and herbal supplement kind of drug interactions. It's a compendium. It's updated regularly. And so the way I look at much of what we do is that we're eating food. Most of the supplements we do are really foods that we would normally have eaten otherwise. And so if you think about what you're eating in the food, forget the labels on the package stuff with all the things that are in there. Just the foods themselves have so many different chemicals in that all have the potential for interaction, but they tend not to be a problem. There are some issues though. So taking minerals before certain medications can actually bind up the medication. So you don't want to take calcium before you take a tetracycline type antibiotic or before your thyroid hormone. And you don't want to take it for 2 hours after, or maybe at least a half hour after if you do the thyroid a little bit. You want to give yourself a space so you don't put those together. So there are some binding interactions. And then there are some other potential problems, but I've not really seen a lot of it truly in the literature. It's an opinion, it's a theory, and I know it's occurred occasionally, but taking fish oil or vitamin E with a blood thinner, they work completely differently. And fish oil is not a blood thinner, it's a blood smoother. And vitamin E is a blood smoother. They don't really thin the blood, but the blood thinners actually make it so you can't clot and you will bleed. And so what happens though is with the blood being more slippery, everybody has little bruises all the time, but they get healed pretty quickly. But if you have something that prevents you from making the clot, then you're going to leak and you're going to see more bruising. The other thing is, one of the keys for bruising is vitamin C deficiency. One of the first signs of scurvy is bruising. So if you bump up your vitamin C while you're on a blood thinner, you increase the integrity of your blood vessel linings and you have less bruising. And so you may actually really fix a problem that you've noticed with bruising while on warfarin or Eliquis or something like that, and you're taking fish oil. Don't stop the fish oil unless you're having actual bleeding problems. A little bruise is no big deal. But if your teeth are bleeding, then you really need to talk to somebody about it.
Now, Blen writes, there's no mention of exercise. Three bowel movements a day possibly at the beginning, but if so continued, it seems like you're eating far too much. So two questions there. How important is exercise? And if you're having three bowel movements a day, does that indicate that you're eating too much?
He's on target with exercise. I had thought about it, but we were talking about her dietary interventions, but for sure, exercise is critical. There are so many good studies on just walking. Walking 20 to 30 minutes a day will turn back the symptoms of depressed mood. It will reverse type 2 diabetes. It will reduce the recurrence of prostate and breast cancer by 30% from someone who is completely sedentary who starts doing some exercise. It's amazing what it will do. And it will also stimulate more bowel movements because when you're moving along a nice rapid pace, you're vertical and gravity works, and that massage of the bouncing and your abdominal muscles helping you walk fast, it all moves it down. And so you can actually achieve those three bowel movements today doing good exercise and the good diet. But as far as eating far too much, like I said, you could have three small high-fiber meals that make a dense packet of at least a cup of material that could go through three times a day. I don't see that that's, a quart of good vegetables fills my belly, and that's got to come out sometime.
Well, you're listening to Fred Harvey, MD, here on WMNF in Tampa. He's on every other Monday at 10 o'clock. And let's go to Sharon in Land O'Lakes. Hi, Sharon. What's your question for the doctor?
Hi. My question is about pain relief. And you mentioned, Tylenol not being good for you and that sort of thing. I'm 50 years old, and I have suffered through headaches and TMJ and some undiagnosed face pain. I take naproxen or Tylenol for the pain, Motrin. I don't want to take it, but I'm also, in pain, and I, it's kind of a double-edged sword, and is there any natural pain relief? I do cold therapy. I rest, when I'm in pain. But I do take Tylenol for the headaches and the migraines or whatever other.
Yes.
And I'm worried because I continue to take the Tylenol and the Motrin and the Naproxen, and I don't know what else to do.
Yeah, there are lots of alternatives. So starting with an anti-inflammatory combination that does help with pain. I like a mix of curcumin extract, turmeric extract, and boswellia, which is frankincense. Those two work really nicely. And if you want to throw some salicylic acid in from willow, you've got a really great potent combination that helps with all kinds of inflammation and then reduces the pain. The thing is, it doesn't work like Tylenol or Advil or Aleve or any of these things because it doesn't actually, it's not a pain pill, but it works on the pain pathways.
Yeah.
So also we have topicals. You could use some capsaicin, hot pepper cream. That's available out in the market. The icy hot kind of mentholated rubs. These topical things actually do have some benefit. They're not a cure for anything, but they do reduce your pain perception. That's the key. We want to reduce the pain perception.
Yeah.
CBD might help that. Medical marijuana might help that. We don't know exactly the dosing, and we don't know exactly how to get it yet because we need to be able to study it. So we need it off schedule one so we can figure out how to use this probably valuable plant. It seems to be. Let's see if we can get more of it. And then you could do body work. I don't know how much you've had access to good massage, acupuncture, physical therapy, doing that kind of work, muscle activation technique. There's all kinds of things you can do to work on these pain problems. I've dealt with them myself, going through some difficulties with my right shoulder rotator cuff. And it's really interesting to watch it evolve as I get a chiropractic adjustment and a massage and a muscle activation release and do some exercise to support what they're doing. At the same time, I have to admit, yes, I take ibuprofen because it does get really painful and I want to be able to sleep at night. So if I roll over on my shoulder and it wakes me up, I'm not going to have a good night's sleep. And
right.
I want to be able to be focused here for you folks.
Yes, exactly. You have to maintain work and family and, all the, obligations that you have. That was some very valuable information and, you know, I'm trying my best to avoid, you know, taking the Tylenol and the other stuff, but it is hard to live with chronic pain.
That's so true.
Thank you so much for being here for us.
All right,
I appreciate your help.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you. Here's a question from Marianne in Myakka City. She says, I'm listening today, and the toxin subject encouraged me to ask about carrageenan. I thought it was okay because it's seaweed, but then later I learned it's carcinogenic. I found it in a probiotic supplement, and I called the company, and they said because it was naturally processed, it's safe. Please ask Dr. Harvey, is carrageenan ever safe?
Their marketing statement was very interesting, and it actually lacks any validity or any backup in scientific evidence. What actually is evident is that carrageenan is something we shouldn't ingest. It works really well to emulsify things for food industries, but I have watched people have anaphylactic shock from it, and I have read that it might be a carcinogen. I don't know that for certain, but from my perspective, if anybody's going to have anaphylaxis from it, which means they have sudden stopping of breathing or a closing throat or itching all over their body like they're having an acute allergic reaction, it makes me think this is a reactive substance that we don't want much to do with.
Is it in ice cream?
It shows up in ice cream. It shows up in all kinds of things. It's usually in dairy-associated things because it's a good emulsifier. It keeps the dairy from separating.
Hmm. All right, let's go to Gary in Palmetto. Gary, you're on with Dr. Fred Harvey.
Hello, how you doing?
Hey, Gary.
Good. Hey, I got a question. I had a major portion of my pancreas removed. And as a result, I'm diabetic, so now I'm loaded up on metformin, Victoza, all kinds of stuff like that. And I'm wondering what I should do to, I mean, I feel like it's just a matter of time, like it's a time bomb waiting to explode.
I hear you. Well, first thing we do is drop the labels. You're not a diabetic. You're a human. I've never met a diabetic. I've met humans that have sugar metabolism problems, but owning the label like Western medicine has us do is disempowering. So you have an insulin production problem because you lost half your insulin producing organ. And right. So the way you deal with that is you take the stress off the insulin producing organ by not needing insulin. I would suggest you might want to look into a ketogenic diet or at least a low carb diet and see if that helps you control the sugar with needing then less medication.
Okay.
Other things you can do that work to improve your insulin sensitivity are to take chromium, like 1,000 micrograms of chromium a day, some vanadium, 5 micrograms of vanadium would be good. Magnesium is also very good for it. Fish oil helps to stabilize your membranes and help you deal with sugar metabolism better. And alpha-lipoic acid is an antioxidant that acts like metformin and increases insulin sensitivity. To see where you are with the whole thing, I would suggest you do a 2-hour postprandial, mean after the meal, blood glucose and insulin test. That way you can find out if your pancreas is responding to the sugar challenge.
Okay. You know, and then the latest thoughts about that is that they have everybody, they're pushing me to take a statin, which I've recently started taking. I've never like the idea of statins, but now they're saying taking diabetic medicine needs to take a statin because of heart issues.
So it is recommended in the Western Medical Algorithmic Cookbook of what to do for people with diabetes. Yes, statins are on there because there is an association with diabetes, high lipids, and heart attack that's so also associated with toxicity.
Okay.
So statins may prevent your first heart attack. They're not that bad an idea in people who actually have high risk. They're a bad idea in people who have very low risk.
Okay. Good to know.
Yes, sir.
All right, Gary.
Help.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Doc.
Thanks.
Welcome.
All right, we just have 30 seconds, but Suzanne wants us to answer this. She says, the doctor was doing well about a vegan diet until he mentioned protein. We all know the world's largest land mammal, elephants, never eat animal protein, and they do just fine. There is protein in almost all vegetables, especially everything green we eat.
You are so correct, and I never mentioned animal protein. I said make sure you get enough protein so that you can actually be strong. Because what I see in my patients, and I see a lot of challenged people because, you know, I'm where the buck stops, essentially. They've been to 20 other doctors. They're coming to me for help. And when I see very sick vegans, they don't get better without more protein. I had a patient with multiple sclerosis who was a devotee of Dr. Furman's Nutritarian diet. She could not walk. She could not get out of a wheelchair. After she started doing 3 eggs a week, she could walk again. Just 3 eggs a week. That's simple.
All right, Fred, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. Thank you so much for doing the show, as always.
Yeah. Thank you.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Okay.
Dr. Fred Harvey, MD, has been here for the past hour. Thanks for listening to WMNF in Tampa, and Dr. Harvey will be back in 2 weeks at 10 o'clock. Next week in this time slot on Monday at 10 o'clock, you'll hear the Sustainable Living Program. This is WMNF in Tampa. Thanks again to Frank Knox, our phone producer today. Let's take a few minutes and get the latest news from NPR. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland.